Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Which is, of course, Morse code for Achtung, Achtung.
That is absolutely my favourite. That's just brilliant.
I'm not very good at Morse. It was a bit slow, wasn't it? It was a bit ham-fisted, but how about that?
Yeah, I wouldn't want you in the middle of the Atlantic with a U-boat crawling around, that's for sure.
Yeah, we're over here.
That's amazing.
What do you think of that?
I love it.
We'll be passing it all through an Enigma encoder next week, and that'll fool all of you. Now then, Morse code was, of course, used quite heavily in the Second World War, largely by shipping. One problem, it took ages to spell out a message, which meant it was prone to detection by direction finding. So what they would use instead was a thing called a burst encoder, where what you'd do is you'd record the message and then fire it out at high speed, so it would come up like that, and then you'd slow it down at the other end. That's incredible, isn't it? Did you enjoy a little bit of Morse there, James?
I loved it. I thought that was completely brilliant. Because I was actually lying awake this morning thinking of kind of weird languages we hadn't actually done yet, but Morse wasn't one of them. So, yeah, brilliant. Absolutely.
Yes.
Love it.
It's always amazed me when you see people who are adept at Morse, how fast they go and how natural they are with it. So I always think it's one of those really amazing human skills and trained skills. Right, okay, so down to business, a few parish notes for you all. First, we hope you enjoyed our live stream last week. We certainly did, enjoyed it enormously. Around 750 of you joined us live and bombarded us with some brilliant questions and outrageous comments. It's available on YouTube if you'd like to watch it back. I haven't watched it back. I'm not,
Oh, it's a bit weird even watching yourself, isn't it? It is.
Well, decades doing telly, it is like it's worse than your voice on the answer phone message by like a million. I mean, Frank Skinner's a sort of pal of mine, and he's quite happy to sit and watch himself on TV and slaps his thigh laughing at his own stuff, which is kind of which is very peculiar. But I can't do it. I can't bear it. But so I haven't watched it back. Well, I enjoyed it enormously. You enjoyed it, didn't you, James?
Yeah, no, I did. I really enjoyed it. I loved getting all the messages in sort of real time as we were doing it. It was fun.
Yeah.
So, I'm all up for that and up for doing more.
Brilliant.
The thing about kind of listening to yourself back is I have this really bad habit of start aping people's accents. I just can't help myself. It's terrible in India, as you can imagine. Or the deep south of America and stuff. So I have to constantly watch it.
Anyway, the way that the live stream went really made us think about our battle plans going forward. So here's the plan. And this plan works on a strategic, operational and tactical level. We've decided to create a members club, which we're going to call the We Have Ways Independent Company. This way, we'll be able to do a live stream of the pod each week. It'll also enable us to provide more audio book readings, our own chat forum, and a place for you all to tell us your family stories. Because that's one of the things that's been coming through via social media that we really, really like. We plan to read the best of them out on the pod each week, but they'll be there for you to digest, compare notes and comment on, which is really exciting because the interaction is really the thing that makes this podcast, for me, particularly special. We're going to keep an up-to-date reading list on there. Plus, I'm reading John Buckley's masterful, it's his thesis really turned into a book about armour in Normandy, British and Canadian armour in Normandy, and which I think we might be pulling then is really on my mind. And so that's whatever I'm reading will go up. Our favourite books will go up on the reading list. And you know, hopefully you'll then say, well, I read that and I thought it was pants. When this crisis is over, the plan is to take this show on the road in some shape or form. And members of the independent company will, of course, get first dibs on discounted tickets. Don't worry if it's not for you. We'll still be producing two weekly pods in all your usual places. So there's your standard membership. Then there's platinum. Okay, so
and we're also amassing a whole load of goodies, aren't we?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So, so our first live broadcast for independent company volunteers will be this Thursday evening at 8:30 p.m. Thursday night, 8:30, a live stream. That's kind of when a history programme of this kind for people of the like minds would probably be on, say, on a broadcast. That's probably the kind of time they put it out, isn't it?
Back in the day.
9 o'clock.
Back in the day, BBC Two.
Back at
8:30, 9 o'clock. That was it.
So you don't need the BBC anymore. You've got us. How about that? Now, this will cost a fiver. It's going to cost a fiver because actually arranging all this stuff. Yeah, a fiver a month. Piecing this stuff together, putting it out there, the technology and all that sort of thing does cost us a few pennies. And we want to be able to bring you the best content we possibly can. So because even though James and I are talking to each other now, I'm looking at a live screen with two other people, one of whom makes notes and goes, oh, God, they've said that again, and then edits it brilliantly so you never know, so it's gone or it makes it sound cleverer. And then there's an evil genius mastermind top left in my screen surveying all before him, and judging by the screen behind him in the Zoom, he lives in a big house, so he's got overheads. Anyway, James and I will tweet the link to join, and we hope to see as many of you as possible, because it's the more the merrier with We Have Ways. It's as simple as that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, and a quick word on your brilliant reading of Zeno's Arnhem novel, The Cauldron, Al, which a lot of people seem to enjoy. There's 12,000 of you listening each day, hopefully loving the story, finding some distraction from our current national crisis. We do want to do a bit more of this, don't we? And
you're going to
be reading Dennis Barnum's fantastic account of his time as a Malta Spitfire pilot in 1942. Yeah. And I love that book because I just think it's so vivid. But I mean, the aerial sequences are just amazing.
Well, I've made a start on it. I've read the first couple of chapters, and he's a fascinating guy because before the war, as a teenager, he wants to become an artist. And his descriptions of him figuring out his artistic muse and what he thinks the universe is saying to him, and how he gets religion, and how he reconciles himself to war and all that sort of thing. And it's a fascinating book. And the action hasn't started yet. We're on the USS Wasp. On the way. Yeah, to let the Spitfires take off as close as they can to Malta with their extra fuel tanks. I'm very excited about reading it. And I've been... because he was a painter, the descriptions are incredibly vivid.
Yeah, and I'm very good mates with his older son, Oliver, and also his younger son, Michael. They're great people. And Oliver's a real character because he's got absolutely an amazing collection of militaria and ephemera. And he used to take Dennis, his mother, off on trips to France back in the day when you could sort of, you know, put a 57mm anti-tank gun on the back of a Land Rover and put it on the ferry to Brittany. No problem at all. So he used to do all that kind of stuff. And he's actually rebuilt a Japanese tank, which is now at Bovington at the moment. He's amazing. But anyway, he's all for it and he's thrilled that you're reading it, as am I.
So when this is all blown over, we'll go see him and perv on his kit.
Yeah, he's the guy who gave me a Bren gun. He said, James, have you got a Bren gun? I went, no, I haven't actually. And he goes, well, would you like one? I think you ought to. And I said, well, that'd be lovely. Thank you very much, Oliver. That'd be brilliant. So that's how I got my Bren gun.
Right. Well, I hope he's got another one.
He's a lovely fellow. He's a really, really good chap.
Oh, well, excellent. Well, his father's book is fantastic. Right. Should we begin?
I can
tell you're all stuck at home with idle hands because our metaphorical post bag is heaving. Loads to get through, and we thought it would be nice to start today with some of your stories. This is from Jay Martin, or it might be Martin Jay. Twitter's not ideal on some of these things, and it's an incredible story. You're going to love this, James. As James is currently writing a book on Sicily, I thought you guys might be a little interested in an episode my grandfather, Harry Keats, was involved in, Operation Fustian, Primosoli Bridge, which we talked about last time.
Yep.
Right? He was a medic in Number 4 Section, 16th Para Field Ambulance. Hmm. And he always said to my uncles how he got shot down and ditched in the sea. Years after his death, I did some digging and found his actual operational report on the incident. See below. Report by Captain A. Percival, REMC, on Operation Fustian. Number 4 Section and myself left Landing Strip B at 19:50 hours on 13th July 1943 using a Douglas C-47 aircraft. The section consisted of one officer, one staff sergeant, one corporal, one Lance Corporal, 12 privates, Royal Army Medical Corps, and one driver from the RESC. The flight was uneventful, and we got our 20-minute warning at 22:35 hours. So they're going over the med. Yep. As we were hooking up, The aircraft was fired upon by a convoy. Ow! And that, when people say, what are the white stripes on aeroplanes in 1944, the D-Day white stripes,
that's
what they're for. That's why. Fired upon by a convoy. The second burst of anti-aircraft fire hit us and put the controls out of action. The pilot made a forced landing in the sea at 22:45 hours. We were then about 17 miles east of Syracuse. As the aircraft was landing, we took off our parachutes and got dinghies ready for use. We then sat down and prepared for the shock of the landing. The pilot made a perfect landing and nobody was injured. I detailed two men to go out through the escape hatches. They got out onto the wings and we passed them each a dinghy. I then detailed another six men to get out, three to each escape hatch. By this time, the plane was filling rapidly with water and the escape hatches were underwater. So I told the rest of the men to file out of the jumping door. They did so in an orderly fashion until eventually the plane was totally submerged. I think that at this time, there was Staff Sergeant Anderson, Corporal Amos, Private White and myself left in the plane. Staff Sergeant Anderson and myself managed to swim out of the aircraft, which was down 30 feet below water at the time. Apparently, Corporal Amos and Private White failed to get out. We all gathered around the dinghies for about 20 to 30 minutes until we were picked up by a Greek destroyer. I was then able to check up on who was missing. There was Corporal Amos, Private White, Private Wheeler and Driver Wendt. We failed to see either of the last two mentioned in the sea using the ship's searchlight. Eventually, we were taken to Malta, docking there at 0700 hours on the 14th. Signed, Percival, Captain REMC, Officer in charge of the section, Commander of the section, at Field, 16th July 1943.
How amazing. Isn't that amazing?
Absolutely.
And also, it's just the incredibly bold, sort of stark language, isn't it? By this time, the plane was completely submerged. We had to swim out 30 feet.
Yeah, I detailed two men to get out of those bloody escape hatches.
Jesus.
You're right. That is amazing. You're right.
I mean, how terrifying must that have been? I mean, unbelievable.
Well, how much kit? And the other thing, how much kit are these parachutists carrying? Although they're medics, so they're not all armed. They're not armed to the teeth, are they? But they'll have kit bags with plasma in and or whatever, or medical supplies. So if you're 30 feet below water in hobnail boots, and they've ditched their parachutes, which are incredibly heavy parachutes, they've ditched their chutes. You're in hobnail boots with a steel helmet on. I mean, you probably flung your helmet off, but do you know what I mean? That's tough to get. I mean, you know, it's absolutely amazing. And then there's a footnote. There's a sad note to this story. It was just a week after my granddad's untimely death in 1978. A gentleman knocked on the door of my nan's flat asking for Harry Keats. After being informed that he had just passed away, the man, who was Scottish, said he'd been searching for years to find him and said if it wasn't for my granddad, he would have drowned in the sea.
Oh.
He also asked if Harold had escaped from Arnhem, as he said lots were captured. How about what a story?
Wow.
Gosh, that is really J. Martin or Martin J., whoever you are. Thank you. That is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I've just been reading about an amazing crash this week, actually, Al, that Monty was involved with.
Really?
On the 28th of July, 1943. So he was going off to... So what happened was this big meeting between Alexander, Patton and Monty at Syracuse on Sunday, the 25th of July.
Yep.
Basically, they were going to talk out stuff.
Yeah.
And Monty goes, well, I think it's absolutely great that you're performing so well. So I'd really like your boys in the 7th Army to give a really good effort on the coastal road and on Highway 120, which is the one that goes through Nicosia and to Troina on the northern flank. And Patton is really suspicious about this. You know, what's the catch? What are these bastard limeys up to and all the rest of it? And actually, there's no catch whatsoever. You know, he just genuinely thinks it would be great if the Americans helped a bit.
Yeah.
And well, originally he was into, you know, the original plan was to burst into the Catania plane, get Catania, push on up to Messina, and it will all be over in sort of 10 days. That was the kind of best case scenario based on the very rapid success they'd had in the initial invasion. So that was why 7th Army to start off with had a secondary role. But as the campaign develops, obviously it makes sense to bring 7th Army into the fold. Anyway.
Yes.
Patton has his nose massively put out of joint because Monty hasn't arranged a band or fanfare or razzmatazz or laid on a lunch or anything. So basically, they've had this meeting.
That would bother me.
Well,
honestly,
it bothers Patton.
I mean, when I come round to yours and there aren't pipes and drums, I get pretty annoyed.
Well, I have noticed that. So anyway, 3 days later, they're going to finalise their plans. So the idea is the kind of final phase of kind of mopping up the island is going to start on the 1st of August. So they go for another meeting and he flies over. And you'll remember that Monty has this B-17, which he's won in a sort of bet and absolutely insisted Eisenhower kind of honours. So he loves this B-17 and he insists on flying over there. So he's got Harry Broadhurst, who's the commander of the Desert Air Force at the time, on board. He's got Freddie de Ganga, you know, his chief of staff and various others.
Yeah.
And they fly into Palermo, but the airfield at Palermo isn't long enough for a B-17. So as they come off the hit, they touch down. The pilot suddenly realises that they're going to crash into a hangar at the far end if they're not careful. So he has to apply massive brakes, and they're still not stopping enough. So he then puts brakes on one side, opens the throttle on the engines on the other, so that the plane veers off to the port side. And the whole undercarriage collapses. The wing tips the ground. One of the engines gets smashed. Anyway, the whole time, Monty's just reading a book.
Of course he is.
Gets off completely unharmed.
Yeah.
Not in the slightest bit fussed. Makes really no issue about it whatsoever. They then go off and see Patton. Patton has laid on marching bands, guards of honour, the whole thing. He's set himself up in the Palazzo dei Normandiae, which is the kind of, you know, the royal palace in Palermo, the whole shebang.
Well, because of course...
Still
because,
absolutely suspicious.
And you say Normandiae because, after all, the Normans conquered Sicily. was one of the
of course,
one
exactly.
of the one of the destinations. I mean, the peculiar historical links that span the centuries there. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and I've just been writing about the castle of Roger II of Normandy, over which this is the Azzurro one that the Canadians were fighting up. Anyway, so he has this very, very near-miss crash, which if I'd read that before, I'd completely forgotten about it.
Yeah. And there's your
what-if. Just imagine if that hadn't been for the... Yeah, that's your what-if, because if it hadn't been for the cool-headed, quick thinking of the pilot, I mean, they'd have probably all died.
Yeah, they'd have
all
been killed, yeah. And it'd be like...
Blow up, boom, good night, Charlie.
Like Bertram Ramsey. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Incredible. That. Well, we're going to take a short break while I bring up the Piat. See you in a moment.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Well, we've dug in during the Battle of Corona Bulge, but it isn't stopping us getting plenty of podcasting out there. A mildly exasperated Donald Henderson has been in touch after listening to my reading of The Cauldron. Zeno's Cauldron is, of course, impossible to find. He also wrote Four Sergeants about Sicily. And he read that. Is it any good? Also based on his own experiences? Question mark. Love the podcast, by the way. My go-to pod. Yeah, sorry about that. You used to be able to pick up copies of the
Cauldron. I don't know about that book.
Yeah, well, Four Sergeants, nor do I. I mean, I've only read The Cauldron by Zeno, but he did write quite a lot of this kind of hard-boiled war fiction. I mean, you used to be able to pick up copies of The Cauldron for a couple of quid before I started reading it and talking about it online.
I need to quickly look up Four Sergeants before this goes live then, don't I?
Yeah, I think probably. You won't be able to get your hands on it. There are no paperbacks, and Amazon has one hardback for £124.95.
Wow. Hold on,
we're setting the agenda in out of print Second World War books. Four Sergeants. Right, a cracking piece of correspondence from Dr. Guy Bowman of Exeter University. First, may I say how much I enjoy your podcast. I think that's saying loving the show, but kind of like the way of an academic would. First, may I say how much I enjoy your podcast, citation needed, and the work that you're trying to do to widen understanding the Second World War. Thank you very much. That is sort of what we're trying to do. I have recently written a book called The Indian Contingent, The Forgotten Muslim Soldiers of Dunkirk, which concerns Force K6 of the Indian Army mule drivers from the RIASC, who joined the BEF in France and were evacuated in May and June 1940, some from Dunkirk. One company of 320 men ended up in POW camps, and the stories of their captivity, some joining the German army and some escaping, are fascinating and completely unknown. The rest of the men stayed in the UK until early 44 and made friends up and down the country, usually in small towns and villages. They fell in love and left several babies behind. All these stories are told in the book. Best wishes, Guy. Now, have you read this, James?
No, I've got it, and I've flicked through it because we were thinking of trying to get him in on the at the Chalk Valley History Festival, which obviously is sadly no more. Yeah, and it's an amazing story, and it wasn't one I really knew about, I've got to say. I mean, I knew there were some Indian troops there. Because everyone gets very hot under the collar when they watch Dunkirk and go, well, there were Indian troops at Dunkirk. And actually, there were. And the interesting thing about Force K is that...
Because of course there were, because the Second World War is a British imperial and dominion effort.
Yes.
It isn't plucky little England. It isn't the UK. It's an imperial effort. So of course there were.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely fascinating. And what's also interesting is why the Force K6 muleteers were all Muslim. And that was because... Yeah. So they were all Pashtuns and Pathans from what is now Pakistan. And the reason was because whenever you get Indian troops involved, because there's many different religions and all the rest of it, they have all these different ration scales. And so they didn't want to complicate things. And Muslims have a less complicated... food requirements than Hindus, which is why there were Muslims out there rather than Hindus or all the rest of it. By all accounts, they did very well. Most of them were picked up. There was some 2,500 of them. Most of them were picked up and got back across the channel. But there was this one company that didn't make it. And one of them managed to escape from his POW camp by pretending to be a French colonial troop.
Right.
I don't know why that was particularly important, and why that was different, but that was the case.
Well, because there was an amnesty, wasn't there, with French prisoners of war. Later in 1940, wasn't there, where people released.
Maybe
the
that's
war, they captured
it.
The
yeah,
Germans,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's
maybe.
How he. And so he passed himself off as a French colonial.
Yeah,
in order to get out. That must be. I mean, I'd love to read this. This sounds absolutely fantastic, because this is the thing. This also goes back to stuff we were talking about, Dan Tobin, and all the stuff about British power and British reach. What was at Britain's disposal at the start of the war, which is this massive imperial effort. And here you have, I mean, there are mule drivers, but what you can see is, if it came to it, let's say that you end up with a stalemate trench warfare thing on the. In Europe, and that they don't break through at Sedan and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That the Ardennes Falgelb doesn't work. Eventually, you're looking at soldiers, lots and lots of Indian soldiers on a front line in France fighting the Germans, and that's the long term kind of projected thing. And then the Indian Army, of course, are all over the desert and all over. We talked about Iran and Iraq. Again, quite recently,
yes.
The Indian Army feature heavily all over the. You know, it's just in Europe, which is the bit people think of as the war primarily.
Well, it's the larger. The Indian Army. Indian Army is the largest volunteer army the world has ever known. 2 million volunteers. Yeah. I mean, I know there's some debate about just how voluntary they were. You know, but. You know, but they were volunteers. I mean, you know, there was huge peer pressure within certain groups to kind of join up together and in certain areas and all the rest of it. And also with the Gurkhas as well, there was the thing.
Well,
that's what you did.
But also tied into that, British racial ideas about martial races, that some of the Sikhs particularly were suited to military service.
Yes.
And other parts of India, peoples in India weren't reliable as soldiers, and so you say a volunteer army of 2 million. How big an army if they'd never been able to introduce conscription in India, but if they'd really tried hard to recruit people, a massive army could have been delivered, I suppose. I mean, that's
I remember interviewing
although
this
the
guy.
politics
I remember interviewing this guy called Mandeep Singh, and he lived in a very small village. You know, he was a sort of peasant family, incredibly poor. Yeah. He got married because that was arranged by his parents, and they suddenly realised they hadn't got any money, and the recruitments were coming round, and he suddenly thought, well, that sounds like a bit of a solution to a problem. I'll get a job. So literally, he went off and he didn't see his wife again for 4 years.
But that's how men have joined the armies of the world, time immemorial.
I guess you're absolutely right. But it was just so interesting, this whole process.
Yeah.
You know, and I said to him, well, you know, weren't you a bit kind of, you know, were you a bit not any concerns about kind of just leaving this your village that you've lived in all your entire life and suddenly being shipped over to Egypt? He was, no, it was all quite interesting,
nah,
really.
Nah, not really.
Yeah, literally. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
But, okay, so I've got the name of the guy who escaped. He was called Jemadar Jayan Dad. He disguised himself as a French colonial soldier, and got to Gibraltar in the end. And apparently he went over the Pyrenees, or maybe he got a boat, I don't know. But anyway, he got to Gibraltar, but he'd already served 26 years in the British Indian Army at the time of his capture.
Wow! It's, what is a Jemadar? That what rank is that?
It's a sergeant,
what's
isn't
that
it?
The equivalent
it's
of?
It's a sergeant, I think. Isn't
I think
it?
I've just. I mean, I'll be honest. I've just.
I knew this. I knew this when I was writing Burma 44, but yeah. Some information goes to the back of the filing cabinet, the mental filing cabinet.
The rank remained in use in the Indian Army until 1965 as the lowest rank of junior commissioned officer.
Oh, okay. So that's like a second lieutenant for 26 years. Maybe he got a sort of commission in the field, sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Also, opportunities for promotion in the Indian Army had British people in your way if you're an Indian.
Yes, that's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Didn't they?
Yeah.
You know,
but it's an amazing story.
Havildar is a sergeant. And I think a huge thanks to Guy for getting in touch. And that's the kind of book that will appear on the Patreon when we've got it up and running on our books. Maybe you should try a reading list, things we're interested in. Because we want to, you know,
we're going to put some chit chat on there, aren't we? We're going to post stuff.
Plenty of chit chat. Yeah.
Pictures of ephemera and family, and all sorts.
Yeah, and family stories as well. Because I think the one we had just now from Jay Martin or Martin Jay, we'll never know. Please write to let us know. It's just the sort of thing we're interested in, because it's that sort of patchwork of individual experiences that you know, you can weave together and create a fuller picture. I think. Put that quite well.
Surprising,
really.
Definitely.
Anyway, we have to go. That's it for today. Xeno will be finished this week. Where the hell are 30 Core? A reminder, we'll have our Thursday bonus app. Thursday bonus app on first thing. And then we'll be live streaming on Thursday evening at 8:30 p.m. UK time. More on that to follow on our app We Have Ways pod Twitter account. We'll be letting you know the details for that. We'll be retweeting it and letting you know. Thanks very much. Cheerio, all.
Cheerio.